97.9 FM and chapelboro.com present Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, providing interesting guests and topics for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. And now, here's D.G. on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Ernest Dollar is the soon-to-be, and maybe is, the former, by the time we are broadcasting this, the former preservation director of the Preservation Society of Chapel Hill. And he's the newly appointed executive director of the Raleigh City Museum. And so I love Ernest Dollar, and he's meant so much to this community. I wanted him to come in and tell us goodbye and maybe, you know, tease him a little bit about getting us all excited about history and then leaving us in lurch. Ernest Dollar, thanks for everything you've done for Chapel Hill and Carborough and the surrounding area and for, just for all of these things. Let's talk about some of them.
Well, first off, D.G., thank you so much for having me on. And I think certainly through the help of the radio station and Chapel Hill News and all the other press outlets, I think of all the things I've been able to accomplish in Chapel Hill, thanks to you guys for helping me get that message out. And it's become such a valuable part of what I've been able to do in Chapel Hill is through your guys' help. So thank you.
Well, I think everybody in the news reporting business or in the community building business would thank you, because what a great privilege it's been to work with you. Now, all right, so is a big promotion, right? Or how you feeling? I mean, you're really excited about going to Raleigh?
I'm a little bit of melancholy. As most of your listeners know, there's some type of toxin in the air in Chapel Hill. Like, once it gets into your blood, it makes it so hard to leave. So leaving Chapel Hill is a little hard. And, I've always said that if I can get a job where I don't have to go down I-40, it'll be a good job. So now I'm traveling down 40, so we'll see how that works.
So you're going to – where do you live? You live
– In Durham.
In Durham, so you got a pretty good shot.
It'll be a long haul, but I'm excited. The Raleigh City Museum has just undergone a huge transition. Like the Chapel Hill Museum, they had been a nonprofit. Like the Chapel Hill Museum, had been hemorrhaging money. But unlike the Chapel Hill Museum, the city fathers in Raleigh stepped in and took over the museum and sort of assumed control of it. So they're getting all new staff, all new exhibits, restoring the museum, renovating the building, new programs, even changing the name of the museum. So it is really sort of a rebirth of that museum. So it is it's an exciting time for a person who loves history and has a background in museums like myself to get in and basically rebuild this museum.
Well, is your assignment going to be to take over the museum with existing exhibits and then transform it, or has it been transformed and you're going to take charge of it? How does that work?
I will probably be the new director as the city is hired. So I'll actually be a city employee. And they want to totally renovate all of the exhibits. So, you know, with my background in art and history, to be able to sort of craft and rebuild and put together a vision of what all these new exhibits would look like, That's
well,
exciting.
Is it going to be? You said that the museum will be reopening.
Yeah,
but it's going to be reopening with the exhibits as they were when the museum closed.
Right. So we're going to sort of phase out all those and bring in all new exhibits.
But it'll be open as you do this. Mm-hmm. And so now, how does this compare with what you've been doing in Chapel Hill?
Well, when I before I got to Chapel Hill, I was running the Orange County Historical Museum. I was director there, and when I saw this job open in Chapel Hill, I was like, preservation. It's a close cousin of museums, and how dreadfully wrong I was.
Oh, really? Well, now what is the difference?
being in preservation, you're much more an advocacy role. You know, you have to carry those torches and pitchforks and those bullhorns and really get out and broadcast your message to the community. Whereas museums, you do that a little bit, but you have people come in and, you know, tell these stories of the community through these artifacts and through these relics of the community. So it's a
little
different.
Missed when you came in and did preservation work and were surprised to find out it wasn't exactly like museum work. Did you miss the museum? Did you miss your job at the Orange County Museum?
Again, when I started in Orange County, I was basically building a museum. When I started work there, it was like working in your grandmother's antique store. You know, handwritten labels, all the stuff out on tables. So to build the exhibits, you know, try and develop the collections, programming, it was a hard road to hoe. So when I got to Chapel Hill, a lot of the mechanisms were in place because the Preservation Society has been there for 40 years. But to get out and sort of reintroduce the Preservation Society to the community, to sort of reengage the public, to rededicate ourselves to the mission that we were supposed to do was also very similar for what
Remind us again what the mission was and is.
Our job is to sort of protect the cultural and heritage of Chapel Hill's built environment and its historic landscapes.
So you're preserving physical objects.
Right.
But you did a lot of programs preservation-wise that got us all excited that didn't have anything to—I mean, it had relationships, but they were basically programs to make us feel good about where we lived and learn about where we lived. It was like a museum director would be doing.
Pretty much. I brought a lot of the experience from Hillsborough to Chapel Hill. And, you know, when I first got to Chapel Hill— the previous October, in October 2006, the Dye House had been torn down on Rosemary Street. And we had some very angry members at the Preservation Society had called up and left obscene phone calls on our voicemail saying, you know, do your job, stop having so many tea parties.
It's your fault for this, not our fault, but your fault for letting it be demolished.
Right. So this is sort of where I had to start from. And I realized that, you know, the community had lost a lot of confidence in the Preservation Society. So, you know, through the programs, all the crazy programs I did to sort of get people excited about history, I had hoped that would sort of bring them back to a understanding that history is valuable. History can be fun. History is exciting.
I mean, you're sort of telling us, look, we can't preserve, we can't do as good a job preserving if it's a vacuum, if there's not an understanding and an appreciation through the community of why these buildings are important. And it's more than just the architecture of the building.
It is. And, you know, I've racked my brain, especially in the shadow of the closing of the museum. It's like, how does Chapel Hill intersect with its history? I was, you know, did a lot of soul searching to try and figure out. And a couple of things I've determined. We are a very transient community, a lot of students, professors coming in. So there's that natural disconnect from the history here. But I really started to question, as a very liberal community like we are, Most of these folks, we're more excited to look toward the future and look to the present. And we often look back at the past as a painful experience, especially a Southern past could be very embarrassing for folks. So there's this great disconnect or there's not a value placed on history in Chapel Hill.
Wow. I mean, that's heresy, isn't it, for you to say that? This is the center of North Carolina history.
It is, but, you know, even, dare I say, I could say this as I'm leaving, that the university is trying to get away from its stodgy brand about, you know, everybody outside Chapel Hill put so much a emphasis on tradition of the university, but the university is trying to get away from this stodgy perception of itself, which I think is a great detriment to the community, not only for the university, from the community standpoint, if they don't really value this history that sort of tells us who we are as we go forward, if we don't sort of have this trajectory to either deviate from or to follow, then how do we sort of find our way
into the future? Well, I guess a healthy community strives for a balance between appreciation for the history and learning from it without being totally absorbed and living in the history so that we don't face the challenges of the present. I mean, that's a chore,
the balance. But I think, you know, in Chapel Hill, we've sort of moved too far to one side away from this history. You know, the example I use, the Peace and Justice Plaza out in front of the old post office. How can you understand the meaning of that without understanding war and injustice? How can you sort of make the case that this is needed without understanding the pain and the problems of the past to figure out what to change? So if we don't look past, how can we change the future?
Well, we're visiting with Ernest Dollar, who is the now former preservation director of the Preservation Society of Chapel Hill and the new executive director of the Raleigh City Museum. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on 97.9 FM, WCHL. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Ernest Dollar, and it was sort of in the occasion of his transition from the preservation director for the Preservation Society of Chapel Hill to his new work over in Raleigh as the director of the Raleigh City Museum. You know, this is, I mean, you can talk about this now, but you're over there as the executive of the Preservation Society, and you're having to watch while Chapel Hill gives up its town museum. You're going over to a place that preserved it. What happened?
I don't really know. You know, I had an old World War II veteran that worked for me in Hillsborough, and he said, you know, stories like this are like divorce. There's his story, her story, and the real story somewhere in between. But again, I think to get back to what we were talking about before is that how much value does Chapel Hill put on its past? You know.
All right. Well, now you're going to be so diplomatic. You don't need to be diplomatic anymore. And I mean, all of us respect all of the characters who were involved, and we move forward with an understanding that many of us who missed the museum didn't step forward and do what we needed to do during the time when it might have been possible to do. But it is a signal to back up your assertion that Chapel Hill is maybe not as history is not as popular as it might be, as you might think it is, that we didn't have enough collective appreciation of a museum of history
I think it's even bigger than the museum. I think if you look at the town planning department, for instance, there's nobody there who's really dedicated to historic preservation in town. If we look at tourism in Chapel Hill, we're not really big tourism people. We don't even have a bed and breakfast. Those are outlawed in Chapel Hill. That's sort of an indication of, you know, of history in town. And I think that whenever I talked about history in the community, that I knew I had to appeal to people's wallets rather than their hearts. You know, not everybody's warm and fuzzy about history, but everybody's got a wallet. And so whenever I sort of projected the understanding of history, the embracing of history, is to look at it through heritage tourism. And this is sort of a great untapped resource in Orange County and Chapel Hill to sort of say, we've got a rich and deep history here. Can we not utilize this history to bring in more money to this community, to offset all of those wonderfully high property taxes everybody pays? But it's just sort of a concept that nobody has really embraced.
Well, you're moving to the Raleigh City Museum, and as you've explained to us, the Raleigh City Museum was a nonprofit in trouble, and the city took it over. In Chapel Hill, we had a nonprofit in a city-owned building having some economic problems, and through the collective efforts or non-efforts, the museum just had to quit. The city didn't pick it up. I mean, there was no plan for the city to pick it up. So what was different? What's different about Raleigh from Chapel Hill? Why was Raleigh able to do it and Chapel Hill could not do it?
Raleigh has over the past couple of years, been investing in their cultural resources. They've, in this big move to take over the museum, they've created a cultural resource department in the Parks and Rec department. There's the Pope House, or the Pope family, prominent African-American family in Raleigh. They're bringing that online as a historic site. The Morgan Latta University and House, that's another African-American historic site they're investing into. So Raleigh has sort of understood that investing in these cultural resources will have a long-term payoff, not only for the standard of living in Raleigh. People have some place to go and learn this history. It makes them a unique community. It gives them a draw of visitors, and it just makes them distinctive. So in Chapel Hill, I don't think there's a real interest in attracting a lot of tourism. We love those game day folks, but they come and they go. So to sort of have this sustained tourism is something I don't think Chapel Hill is really very keen on. And you know what they say about Chapel Hill is that once you discover Chapel Hill, you get here and you close the door behind you and hopefully no one else finds it. And the next people do the same thing. So I don't think Chapel Hill has really been smart about saving its history or sort of valuing its history enough to look at it as an economic revenue generator, to look at it as a defining factor of what makes Chapel Hill really distinctive. You know, we always think the university is going to save these places and save those buildings. But with the university trying to get away from this dodgy atmosphere, who's left?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you were over there at the Preservation Society, and you had a building that's that the society owns, the Horace Williams House.
Incorrect.
Ah.
We are owned by the university. So for 39 years, the Preservation Society has paid for the upkeep and maintenance of that building. So now we are facing some big ticket items to restore that building.
So, you're telling us we got the same pending crisis that the Chapel Hill Museum faced in terms of an arrangement with a landlord who's generously letting you use the building but isn't paying to keep it modern.
We signed the lease, and at some point in the late 70s, early 80s, that lease changed where a lot of the maintenance was dumped back on the Preservation Society. So we're currently operating the Horace Williams House. Preservation Society is a nonprofit. We're the only historic home open to the public. So we are basically one of the only historic sites in Chapel Hill. So, you know, as we start talking to the university, we're kind of recently been going to them and say, hey, we need some help upkeeping this. You know, some of these major projects like new roof, you know, some major moisture problems in the house, that this is far above what we can sustain in this house. So again, we sort of have looked at the museum in that situation and said, wow, we need to be more proactive and sort of to help.
That could be us in a few years. Well, but when the museum closed, and you're a former museum director, and the museum closed, and all those artifacts are being dispersed, why didn't you grab them and put them in the Horace Williams House?
Yeah, well, you know, we have such a limited space in the Horace Williams House. And I was hoping that, you know, the Historical Society would be a perfect person to sort of to take over, at least hold that collection. But in talking to the town, their occupation of that, the old museum building, 523 East Franklin, their time in there is going to be limited as well. So they might be looking for another place in the next year. So who's keeping the story of Chapel Hill? Who's keeping those memories?
Well, is part of the reason that you're leaving is because you can go over to a place where they do appreciate it, and you feel like, I got to leave behind this place where they don't appreciate history? I've been working hard for all.
Certainly, history has been a hard sell in Chapel Hill, and I think I've taken the Preservation Society as far as I can, and so I think I'm ready to turn it over to somebody else who can take it to the next level. But you know, being in a place that I love so much and have such a close family connection to, it's hard to leave. And, you know, it just makes me want to fight harder to make Chapel Hill realize that this is such a wonderful part of themselves that is threatened to be lost.
We're visiting with Ernest Dollar, who is the former preservation director of the Chapel Hill Preservation Society of Chapel Hill, and the new executive director of the Raleigh City Museum. He and I will be right back.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, a special presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL. Find this and all other episodes of Who's Talking on WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. And now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ernest Dollar is my guest. We're used to calling him the preservation director of the Preservation Society of Chapel Hill. We got to get used to calling him the executive director of the Raleigh City Museum. Will you talk to us about museums? They puzzle me because in some museums, they're just collections of stuff with labels. And usually there are some people associated with those museums who really love that stuff. Mm-hmm. But once you've gone through the museum and seen the stuff, there's not much unless you're really just dedicated to one or two items of those stuff that you have to go see every now and then, there's no real reason to come back. And so museums shift exhibits and stuff like that. You're a professional. How do you face in the lore of museum work today? How do you meet that challenge?
Well, I think most people, they have a preconception of museums, and just like you said, dusty old stuff. You go in, you see it. 10 years later, you come back. It's the same stuff. And I think there's been a museum professionals have realized that that's just not going to cut it anymore. The vitality and life of museums, you have to be give something fresh, new, innovative, and get away from just objects that don't really engage people. So there's a lot of movement to sort of put together exhibits that are you know, challenge people, fascinate people, engage people, puzzle people, to make it fresh. So one of the things I want to do when I go to Raleigh City Museum is to get the museum out of those four walls, to turn the entire city into a museum. And the real emphasis in today's museum world is to push technology. Technology gives you such a great capability in such a small space. So, I've sort of been tinkering around with this in the Horace Williams house. We've got QR codes all over the house. People constantly ask us what these are, but you go in, go up to these little things, you scan them with your smartphone, and you learn all about these objects and these places inside the house that a tour guide would bore you to death to try and listen. But
if it's the object that you want, you got a whole long narrative, mm-hmm. if that's the one thing you came to see.
Yeah, you can explore history at your own rate and pace.
So that's one way to using modern technology to make the stuff come alive in a way it doesn't if you're just looking at it.
And, you know, I think that most of us in American society have been taught history wrong. You know, when we went through school, Coach always got stuck teaching history, and Coach really didn't care about history. So it's always been sort of boiled down to dates, names, and facts. But what is missing is the stories, the really human stories that really engage us. And, you know, we've always heard the cliche that truth is stranger than history. Museums haven't really told that strange truth that we love. You know, we love to hear all the gory bits of history and sort of the scandalous stuff. And I always joke around that if I could tell you where all the brothels were in Chapel Hill, the next time you pass by that house, you will pay very special attention to that house. So to get back to storytelling, we've lost the story.
So you're saying when you take over the Raleigh Museum, you're going to be interested in exhibits, but that's just going to be a part of your time. You're going to be getting people outside the walls of the museum. Well, and how do you, I mean, and say, we're going to declare that this particular, the Mordecai House or some house in Raleigh, this is a part of our, we declare this to be an exhibit of our museum?
Pretty much. Or, you know, to link all of these historic sites around Raleigh and then to sort of give people a technological map or a road plan to go find all these obscure sites in Raleigh. You know, we love exploring these few places. And what better places to go out and find where William Gaston wrote the state song in Raleigh and call up on your cell phone and hear a copy of that dreadful song played over your cell phone, you know, right on Fayetteville Street. You know, I'm a big Civil War buff like yourself. And to talk about the block-by-block history of this great drama that unfolded right in front of the museum is a great way to sort of excite people. So I think museums, if you haven't been to a museum lately, some of the better ones are pretty thrilling to go to. They use video, they use audio, and it's just not looking at musty stuff anymore.
Well, back to the Chapel Hill Museum, was that one of the problems of the Chapel Hill Museum, that the exhibits didn't leap out into the onto Franklin Street?
Well, it's sort of the chicken and the egg. From my understanding of the Chapel Hill Museum, that so much of the money that they grossed through memberships and events and fundraisers went back into maintenance of that building. So they couldn't divert more of that fund to developing those really crackerjack exhibits that excited people. So, you know, if they had signed a better lease when they came on, that agreed that the town would upkeep this building, a lot of that money you would have seen flowing back into the museum. So it sort of seemed like it was a bum deal when the museum moved in there to begin with.
Well, I want to shift gears just a little bit, but it relates to that. And I know you've heard this 1,000 times, so you've got a practiced answer, which is when the museum was in existence, people complained about the three different entities. They couldn't keep them straight. Preservation yeah. Society, Historical Society, and Museum. And people understood that was a challenge, and a lot of people worked hard to sort of explain that, but it's tough to explain. Looking back at it, would it have been better if these three organizations had figured out a way that they could combine their missions and work together and focus the historical support into one common effort, even if it wouldn't be perfect?
Yeah. And, you know, since I've been in Chapel Hill, there's been a lot of discussion around that. And certainly with a community of this size, having that single entity to serve so many needs, I think would have been better. Because, you know, if you look at the memberships of the three organizations when they were around, some of the same people belong to all of them. And I think in my discussions, people can't keep these organizations apart in Chapel Hill. So I think Chapel Hill really wanted us to combine our efforts. And, you know, there's safety in numbers. And you see what happened to the museum. You see what's getting ready to happen to the Historical Society and, you know, what in theory could happen to the Preservation Society. So, you know, my legacy, if anything, to leave it that we need to sort of combine our forces, pull our resources, and make a united front that people in Chapel Hill can say, ah, the historical group.
Well, one of the things that you're first of all, thank you for that. Yeah, that's a great message, a departing message for you, for the us to think about and see if something can't get done in response to that suggestion. What one of the great things about your work is that you got to work at the Horace Williams House, and it's an old building with lots of challenges and all of that. But nevertheless, that must have been kind of fun.
Oh, you couldn't ask for a better office. You know, no cubicles, no fluorescent lights, couches, rugs. To be immersed in history every day of your career is cathartic. You know, it probably lowered my blood pressure several points to working in there every day. And even before I took the job, I was offered another job. So I had sort of torn about, should I take the Preservation Society job or this other job? So I came out to the Horace Williams House one afternoon, and I guess I was expecting a sign, either, you know, Horace Williams in a gilded chariot flying across the sky or some sign I should take this job. And sure enough, I started kicking around and I started finding Native American artifacts in the front yard of the Horace Williams House.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that story. I'm sure you told this story a thousand times. I missed it.
20 feet from Franklin Street were pieces of pottery and flakes where they're making arrowheads. I was like, this is my sign. So the more I worked in the Horace Williams House, the more I realized that, A, Chapel Hill really didn't know what it was, where it was, or how it was being used. But I started to realize just how important this house is into the history of the community and the history of North Carolina, even the history of the United States, that the more I learned about this house, the funkier it got and the more important it got. So it is truly one of Chapel Hill's most overlooked treasures.
And so, is it haunted?
That's, you know, far be it from a director not to promote paranormal tourism. So the story I tell is spending, you know, my first November, I had two different ghost hunting groups in, and that's a kind of experience as well.
What's the story of, if it is haunted or alleged or supposedly haunted, what's the haunting there?
Well, you know, the young girl who saw a man's apparition at the foot of her bed in the 50s when they lived there, that's sort of the only sighting. But, you know, that house has a lot of creaking noises and bounces around and creaks and the toilets flush by themselves. And, you know, it's such an evocative place. And when people come in there, they automatically project. It's funny to watch people just the ambiance and sort of the feeling about the house just overwhelms people when they come in there and they start feeling things, and they start projecting these things that old houses just elicit in us.
Well, is it haunted by Horace Williams?
I have to go back and check the paperwork. I have been in there before, and you'll see stuff out of the corner of your eye, and I've heard the door open and gone to go and to greet guests when they come in, and there's no guest in there. So certainly, some strange things have happened in there, but I've never seen anything per se.
Horace Williams is a name attached to the house where the Preservation Society has its offices, mm-hmm. and lots of events there. And you talk about the importance of our history. It's just a name. I mean, it's Horace, and we got it on the old airport.
Yeah.
So, is Horace Williams anybody we ought to pay any attention to in terms of our history?
When you talk about liberal, when Chapel Hill first, the liberal seeds of liberalism are sowed, Horace Williams he's one of the very first. After the Civil War, when the university closed, George Winston, who lived in the Horace Williams House, looked around to sort of find these liberal professors to come back and really enlighten the youth of North Carolina. You know, the stigma of and shadow of war. So Horace Williams came back, and he did not fail to disappoint in his approach to teaching these children, which was revolutionary at the time. And it was very simple what he did. He just taught all of these young men how to think rather than what to think for themselves, to develop their own logic skills. And it blew their mind.
How did he do that differently from what was being done in the other classrooms?
It was sort of, you went to class, you heard the lecture, you were taught what they wanted to learn what they taught, but you never really got to think time to sort of think for yourself, to sort of, investigate, how does the soul and how does the spirit reconcile with, reality? And, he really just instilled these in his kids, his boys, he called them, to think for themselves.
You think of the classroom in those days of a guy who would get up and give a lecture, and he was a philosopher, I guess. So he didn't get up and give a lecture, I guess. He did something different.
He asked a lot of questions of his students. One of his famous things is, what is the most important part of the horse and cart? The wheels, the wagon, the horse. It was the idea of the horse and cart. It's the most important part. So he really expanded the horizons of a lot of these young men. And a lot of these young men went on to shape America. Paul Green, Edward Kidder Graham, Thomas Wolfe, Sam Ervin, who prosecuted Watergate trials, were all devotees of Horace Williams. So Horace Williams himself is sort of in the shadows of history, but his influence spread much wider than himself.
I love you talking about him, and this is the heroic part of Horace Williams, but the thing that I've heard you and others talk about him on other occasions is that his humanness. I mean, he was not a perfect person.
Oh, people hated him in Chapel Hill. Hated his guts. He was that guy that let his grass grow too tall, shrewd businessman, owned a lot of properties, had notoriously stinky cow barns to the point where his neighbors paid him to let them tear down his cow barn. So he was, that guy who just loved to make other people angry.
Is it fair to say he was a slumlord?
I would say so, a 19th century slumlord. But, it's such a diverse opinion on him between his students and townsfolk.
So I'm just trying to put words in your mouth, but he was a transformational figure in terms of our approach to education. And when we say Horace Williams House, we generally don't think about any of that. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell one or two more stories about Horace Williams, if you will. One of those, which is also important historically, and it came back up in terms as the airport is being closed down, that the background of the property that – tell this story, if you will. And here's the puzzle for me is that the story is that Horace Williams wanted his property to be used to support the effort of teaching philosophy in the university. And somehow or another, the Horace Williams' property is being converted to the commercial exploitation of the sort of the commercial side of the university. And do you know that story?
Now, this is a perfect example of what happens when we forget our past. Horace Williams has become very important of late with the Carolina North, and a lot of people have been scrambling to find his will to see exactly where he left that. So, again, a great example of what happens when we don't value our historic records or archives, these stories about our community. All of a sudden, when this important factor comes up in a project that is going to transform the face of this community, people are lost trying to scramble for the past, the history of this project, the history of this parcel, the history of this land deal between Horace Williams and the university. So I cannot point to a more a perfect example of the importance for our history. Now, from what I've been able to put together, that sure enough, a lot of people have been visiting Horace Williams' will to find out the details. And sure enough, he did leave this property and the Horace Williams House itself to the philosophy department. And at some point, the university did a sort of a swap between the philosophy department, sort of basically endowed some chairs, gave them some money to the department in order for access to this property. So it's fascinating to see how important Horace Williams has suddenly popped up with the announcement of Carolina North.
Well, We're visiting with Ernest Dollar. We're talking about historic preservation because he is the former director of the Preservation Society at Chapel Hill, moving on to be executive director of the Raleigh City Museum. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on 97.9 FM, WCHL. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Ernest Dollar, the former preservation director of the Preservation Society of Chapel Hill, and moving to Raleigh to take charge of as executive director of the Raleigh City Museum. You've been passionate about all different kinds of things, and I'm really wondering what you're worried about the most in terms of the things that need to be preserved in Chapel Hill that are at risk and probably, you know, sadly, probably might not be preserved. What's at the top of your list?
Well, you know, people think about preservation, they always think about the historic districts. The historic districts in Chapel Hill, they're pretty safe. They're, you know, locked down. But as Chapel Hill expands, we expand into a lot of these houses that previously had been in the community. And probably my biggest unfinished project is this Hogan Rogers house. And, you know,
tell us about that.
It's a 1840s house on Rogers Road that we're desperately trying to save. And, you know, it's part of the mitigation between the county and the town in the closing of the dump. In the original agreement, they had promised to build this community a recreation center. So we moved in about a year ago and sort of devised a plan where they can move this 1840s house and restore it and use it as this community center. So that way you'd save a valuable historic part of this community, give these people a new center in which to do their activities like the food bank and children's programs, and also give the community a chance for economic revenue by sort of putting a heritage trail based with this house sort of as the anchor of it. But, you know, in all these mitigation talks that it seems more and more that people are, they don't value the history of this house. They said, well, we want to spend our money and build something new. But whereas the community wants to save this house, they have so many fond memories of this house. The Hogan family who built this house want to see it preserved. And probably the most rewarding day of my career is when we had managed to link back the slave descendants back to this house through DNA, and we had them up, and it was just, you know, an overwhelming experience to see these people standing in this house and to be, just be weeping that they have just sort of been able to step in the footprints of their long-lost ancestors. And, you know, to not value that, you know, it just kills me. And it's sort of representative of just how they view history, that if they move this house and restore it, it'd be a win-win-win for everybody.
So no clear path for that right now.
No, it looks gloomy, though.
It's gloomy. What else are you worried about as you leave? What else are you feeling guilty about you leave?
That's high on the list. Certainly, that's the number one thing that I'll be losing sleep about. That, you know, with such this strong emotional connection to this house, the possibility of rescuing this house, the possibility of, you know, preserving the story, and just the aspect that no one really cares about.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm torturing you about what do you feel the best about? What I mean, as you leave, maybe some things that we don't appreciate as much, but that you feel proud of that has been accomplished.
Certainly, the murals downtown. Every time I see one of those, you know, I sort of think to myself that I had some small part in.
What did you all do to? I mean, Michael Brown printed did all those, didn't he?
But you know, we raised probably around $10,000 to $15,000 to restore five of these, and so. You know, we don't think about these murals.
So when you come back to Chapel Hill and see the murals, I mean, you feel I mean, not that you did it, I mean, but you helped raise the money.
Came up with that plan, raised the money, wrote the checks. But, you know.
Anything top that? Any memory top the murals?
That's pretty high. The Strayhorn House in Carrboro, you know, Ms. Dolores Clark, you know, she was my pediatrician's nurse, and I was able to sort of give her back to save this house. And talking to the people who did the restoration, we came in at the last minute. If that would have been a couple of years, that house would have been in serious, a place where it could not be repaired. So we raised about $15,000 to restore that house.
So we can still drop by and see that house.
It's got a brand new historic plaque on the front.
Well, wow.
So, That's one of my tops to my career here. So to see these places and preserve them for another generation is something I can take with me as a real sense of pride that I've left behind some parts of history for the next generation in Chapel Hill.
What words would you tell not just the people who are part of the Preservation Society, but as you leave, what words would you tell us? Either encouragement or worry or
We're all concerned about growth and all of this stuff, but we rarely consider growth on the shoulders of the past. And again, it just sort of, without knowing where we come from, how can we go farther? And my favorite discussion of late, when I first got here, it was a big discussion, has Chapel Hill lost its cool? And of late, the discussion has been, has Chapel Hill lost its mojo? And if you have to ask those questions, chances are you've lost it.
Wow.
But it gets down to, we've lost who we are. We've lost our authenticity. We've lost sort of our pride in the thing that brings so many people here, these beautiful rock-lined walls, the trees, these beautiful old houses. When these are gone, what makes Chapel Hill unique from Prattsville, Alabama, say? What makes us a unique place that people want to visit? And again, getting back to the university, who wants to have their picture taken in front of the new science building? If you go to the old well in May, everybody's picture in front of the old well.
Wow.
And that sums up basically what we are as a community that we need to hold on to, this tradition. You may not think it's the most hip and forward-looking thing, but it gives us a guidepost into the future.
Ernest Dollar, thanks. We wish you well as you leave us as Preservation Director of the Preservation Society and move to your work as Executive Director of the Raleigh City Museum. Thank you for all you've done for us.
Thank you, DG.
And thanks to you for listening to Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.